Okay. So, yeah, I'd first like to thank the organizer for inviting me to this very nice workshop where there are lots of interesting talks. And so I'm going to talk about another option for simulating the Vlasov equation, which is to use a phase-based grid. And as the previous speaker said, it's difficult if you want to do a Vlasov simulation and grid the whole phase space because it has fixed dimensions. So you've got to do something to reduce the number of grid points. Using a uniform grid is hopeless because you don't have the computers to do it. So what I'm trying to describe here is how we can do to do an adaptive method where you just use the number of grid points that you really need to have a correct description of your distribution function. So first, I'm going to introduce there are many techniques to solve the Vlasov equation on a grid that have been introduced during the last 30 years. And I'm going to stick, because time is short, to the one I'm using here, which is a semi-Lagrangian method. So I'm going to describe it. Then I'm going to give an example of simulation, enhancing why it's very useful to do adaptive simulation, not to do a uniform to use a uniform grid. It's a lot more efficient. Then I'm going to say how we should describe the idea, how we can go towards an adaptive semi-Lagrangian method. So it's based on very simple idea, simple ideas, but in order to analyze and to study, to do some analysis of convergence, it fits perfectly in the framework of bioorthogonal wavelets. And understanding the method in this framework, we can perform some numerical analysis of the method and prove the convergence of the scheme. So at the end, I'm going to describe the actual algorithm we implemented and give some numerical results. So the Vlasov equation, I guess I don't have to stick too long to this transparency. Everybody knows it. Yeah, so of course, because we have to solve the distribution function phase space, it's generally more it's easier to use a particle method because it scales better when you go up in dimensions. The problem is that when you want to do very precise simulations of phenomena that happen in the tail of the distribution function, so at high velocities where generally in the peak codes there is a poor representation in particles, you can't really get a lot of precision. So there are really problems where it's useful to use a phase-based grid where all the regions of phase space are equally well resolved, and so we can do a Vlasov simulation. But the problem is that we want to do a Vlasov simulation which works well and which enables us to go up in dimensions. So we don't want to do just 1D problems. We want to do eventually 3D problems. And so we need to do something in order to have this grid-based methods be efficient. So first, the basic idea of the semi-Lagrangian method, it's very straightforward. It just uses the fact that the distribution function F is conserved along the characteristics, so the particle trajectories. So what you do is you want to update the value of the distribution function at all the grid points. What you do is you follow the particle trajectory that ends at the grid point, and then you know that the new value of the distribution function here is equal to the old value here at the origin of the characteristic. So all you have to do is to, once you've of course computed the origin of the characteristic, is interpolate from the grid point values that you knew from the previous time step. In order for this method not to be too dissipative, you need to use high order interpolation. So if you use just linear interpolation, this doesn't work at all because it's very dissipative. But generally, so the first time this method has been introduced, this was by Cheng and Knorr in 1976, and they used cubic spline. So this still works well, and we've tried other methods, but basically when you use cubic, Lagrange, spline, or Hermite interpolation, or higher order, it works fine. So here to illustrate the need for adaptiveness, I'm using, it's not a plasma simulation, it's a beam simulation. So I'm simulating a beam of I don't know if that's potassium here, that propagates in an accelerator with a periodic focusing force. So here you have a periodic magnetic field that is applied to the beam, which makes the beam oscillate in phase space. So this is X here, and this is V, or actually it's R and VR. What you see here is that the beam, so this is, the blue region is my simulation domain. So when I'm doing a uniform simulation, I've got grid points everywhere. And because it's uniform, I need to resolve this piece well, so I have a very fine grid here also, and I don't use it. So there's really a lot of wasted points. This is an extreme case, but this happens, of course, in beam simulation, because when you see throughout the course of the simulation, all of the grid points here are needed at some point, but at one given time, most of them are not needed. So what we want to do, seeing this, is that we want to have the simulation grid points follow the beam, so to we want them to be where something is really happening, and we don't want too many grid points. For example, here we can have a very coarse grid because the value is zero anyway, so it doesn't really help to have a uniform grid. So now, in order to do something here, we introduce an idea of an adaptive semi-Lagrangian method. So the semi-Lagrangian method is really two very different steps. There's an advection step. This means you follow the particle trajectory. So here you have some particle trajectories which are as many as you have grid points. So if you have fewer grid points, you will have to follow fewer particle trajectories. And then there is the interpolation step. The interpolation step, what do you need when you want to do the interpolation? You don't need uniform interpolation. You want to have sufficient points to be able to reconstruct with any precision you want the distribution function with the grid points you have. So this means that basically where the distribution function is varying more, probably you want to put more grid points, and where it's not varying as much, you want fewer grid points. So this is a problem of approximation theory, which has been studied a lot in the last years, and there is an overview of such techniques, which is in a paper in the Acta Numerica by Devaux, which uses multi-resolution techniques. So it's optimal approximation, where you use an optimal number of grid points for an error that you define. So what we're doing here, instead of constructing a uniform approximation where we first set the grid and then compute an approximation on this grid, is that we construct the approximation layer by layer. So first you do an approximation on a very coarse grid, and then instead of when you want a final approximation of changing everything, putting a fine grid and computing a new approximation on this fine grid, what we do here is we approximate the error between the approximation on the coarse grid and the actual function we have. So the idea is we add layers of precision. So instead of approximating everything at once, we improve the precision. So then when doing this, we see at some point that taking a smaller grid that's locally doesn't help to improve the precision anymore, and then you don't need to do it at these places. So the idea then, seeing this, is that instead of using one uniform grid, we construct approximation on nested grids. So we have first a very coarse grid that we refine progressively. So we put several layers by just dividing by two or whatever. And then we construct several layers of approximation on these different grids. So the idea, actually, what we want to do here is not construct any approximation. We have actually our, say, best numerical solution, which is defined on our finance grid. And what we want to do with this multi-resolution technique is to be as close as this solution on the fine grid as possible, with using as few points as we can. And for this, we just define the distribution function. So to illustrate this, take a function which you approximate on a grid with delta x equals 1 over 2 to the j plus 1. And so this has values which I denote by ck to the j plus 1. And what we do here is we decompose our fj, which is the approximation on our fine grid, in an approximation on the coarse grid plus the missing piece. And so we denote the missing piece as we call them details, what is missing. So when I do this, I don't make an error. I just represent my data differently. Instead of representing the data on the fine grid, I represent the data on the coarse grid plus something which I can use to reconstruct the data from the coarse grid to the fine grid. So in order to do this, I need something which enables me to predict the values on the fine grid from the coarse grid. And I want this to be accurate or exact for polynomials up to some given order. So if I use, of course, a higher order, then it'll be better. So what we're doing here is that we use a prediction which will be based on the Lagrange interpolation of an order. It could be something else, but we use Lagrange interpolation of some order. And by using Lagrange interpolation, we can predict the values at the finer grid from the values at the coarser grid. We have a little cartoon to show this. So first, we know the values at this coarse grid, and we want to compute it on the fine grid, which is the middle here. So what I do is I construct my cubic Lagrange polynomial, which interpolates here at the coarse grid. And then the predicted value is this value. So here I have a scheme to do the prediction from the coarse grid to the fine grid. So now instead of storing what I had before, it's the values on the fine grid, I keep the values on the coarse grid. So I'll take the same values here on the coarse grid. But on the fine grid, instead of storing the value of the function, I'm storing the detail, which is the value of the function I knew, minus the prediction from the coarse grid. So this means that when my Lagrange interpolation is very good, for example, if I have a cubic polynomial, it will be exact, then this detail will be zero. And this tells me that when I have a good prediction from my coarse grid by Lagrange interpolation, then I don't need to keep this detail. And so I remove one point in my grid. So this gives us, of course, I can iterate this. So I go I have my finest grid, then I decompose onto a coarser grid, and then I go on like this, and I do several steps. So here I have my distribution function on the finest grid, which is the approximation I'm trying to reach. So instead of having this, I can decompose it into values on the coarser grid plus details, and I have a formula which links which is invertible, which goes from one representation of the data, which is the values on the fine grid, to the other, which is the values on the coarse grid plus the details that I need to go back to the fine grid. So here I haven't done anything. It's just a different representation of my data. It's a change of basis. But now when I want to do the adaptive method, what I'm going to do, as I said before, the details will be small where the interpolation does a good job from a coarse grid. So in the adaptive method, what I'm doing is transforming my values on the fine grid hierarchically into the values on the very coarsest grid plus the different layers I need to go to the fine grid. And then all the details that will be small will be removed. So by doing the hierarchical decomposition, I haven't done any approximation. Where I'm losing information is when I'm removing details. But here I can estimate exactly what is the contribution of the, or I can estimate what is the contribution of the grid points that I have removed. And in order to understand this well, we can put this into the framework of biorthogonal wavelets, which was introduced by Cohen, Dobeschies, and Fauveau in the 90s. And by expressing this in this framework, so this framework, for those who don't know, in order to define it, we need actually two functions first, the two scaling functions, which are phi and the dual scaling function. And from these, we deduce the psi tilde, which are the wavelets which span actually the detail vector space. So the scaling functions here are just defined by their scaling relation. So basically, what you do here is that you express the function on one scale with respect to the functions on the finer scale. For example, if you have this hat function, when you decompose this, you can express it with respect to the function on the coarser grid. So not very good, and the hat wasn't very very straight, but you can imagine. So you can express this hat on the coarse grid with three values on the finer grid. So it's one half of this one plus one half of this plus one of this. So by doing this, you define completely the function phi. And this is defined by those coefficients hn, which are linked to my Lagrange interpolating polynomial. So when I know the polynomial, the interpolating polynomial, I can compute the hn, and then can compute the basis function. So I have values for this scaling function. So the scaling functions look like this. If I'm using just linear interpolation, then I have the traditional hat function. When I'm using cubic interpolation, then I have a function which looks like this. There's no analytical expression for this function, so I can compute it by subdivision scheme. So you always can compute it at the midpoints of the values you knew previously. So you can compute it everywhere. But you have no analytical value. And then once you know the wave, the details, you can introduce the scaling functions. You can introduce the wavelets that are associated to it. And the important thing is that you have then a vector space decomposition of this vector space is the function on the fine grid, which can be decomposed into a vector space that is spanned by the phi on the coarse grid, plus the detailed space, which is spanned by the psi. And so, because the bases are bi-orthogonal, which means that the phi is orthogonal to the phi tilde, and same for the psi, and the phis are orthogonal to all the psi tildes, we can compute the coefficients on these bases by scalar product. So this is the L2 scalar product with the dual scaling function and the dual wavelet. So just to all that we use from this framework then is that the distribution function can be expressed either on the basis of V J plus 1, which is this. So this is just the traditional. For example, if you use hat functions, it's the value on the P1 finite elements approximation function, or you can use it. You can write it in the dj plus wj, so as a decomposition onto phi plus decomposition onto psi. And then when we use this expression here, what we're going to do in this expression is that we're going to neglect the terms here in WJ, which are smaller than some threshold that we fix, that we set epsilon J, which can depend on the level. This depends on the norm in which we will measure the error. So we see here easily for one term, if we miss one term, we can evaluate exactly what its value is. And because DKJ is less than epsilon J, we have this upper bound for the error. So of course we have several terms, so we can estimate exactly the error we're committing by just removing these terms. Another important feature, which is completely indispensable for such kind of plasma simulation, is that we want, by doing this thresholding procedure, we want to conserve exactly a few moments of the distribution function. If we don't conserve, if we use any wavelet, for example, the procedure I gave before, we don't even conserve mass. We don't conserve the zero order moment. And then when you're doing, for example, two-stream instability, it doesn't work. Your thing gets unstable. But it works very well if you do something to conserve mass, and this is very easy to do, because what you can do is you have your DJ plus a supplementary space. You can just change the supplementary space by using basically you have if your board is the DJ plus one plane, you have one decomposition matrix which can be like this. You have DJ here and WJ like this. And you can use, by taking a linear combination of vector from this and from this, you define another supplementary space, which defines you another oblique projection. And to do this, you just change your wavelets by taking a linear combination of your linear wavelets plus function, plus a linear combination of functions that were in your DJ. And by doing this, you just change the supplementary space, and you see, of course, because you know the moments of this function, you can compute this function, and you compute the coefficients here, so that this function has any number of vanishing moments. And then you conserve moments, and this makes it more stable and work then better, and even work in some cases. Of course, it always works when you use a threshold which is very low. This means when you basically keep most of the points. But what you want is remove as many points as possible. And it appears that when you conserve a few moments, you can remove a lot more moments than lots more points than when you don't conserve them. So here I haven't really explained how the time-dependent algorithm works, because what I've explained is how I just changed the distribution function at one time step to use to be able to reconstruct it with fewer points. So what am I doing for the time-dependent algorithm? So at the beginning, I have an initial value, which is F naught, and I do this compression of F naught onto my hierarchical basis and remove the points. So I have the first adaptive grid. So what I'm doing then is use approximate movement equations to do a prediction of the new grid. So I have more points that I should in the new grid, but I have a lot fewer points than the whole grid. And then I will compute the value of the distribution function at all the points of this predicted grid. Then I do my, doing the advection, so the same thing, an interpolation. And then once I've computed these points, I'm doing again my hierarchical transform to get rid of all the points, of all the grid points which were too many in my last description of the distribution function. Then, so here the algorithm I'm showing here is based on a time splitting procedure, and then of course I do it in the position advection, then I compute the electric field, and then I do the same for the velocity. So to conclude, a few numerical illustrations. So here is just a linear problem. I have this rotating cylinder in a given external field which is given, and we see here these are the grid points which are used by the simulation, and so of course you see that they all are along the discontinuity. Now I have a real problem, a particle beam in a uniform focusing channel, which means that there's a uniform applied electric or magnetic field, and it's semi-Gaussian beam, which means it's Gaussian, it's Gaussian in V, and it's just straight-edged in X. And then we see here, this is there's a discontinuity here, so we have all the points here that gather along the discontinuities. For most of the points, we don't need very many points to represent a Gaussian. And then you see that the grid points follow the variation of the distribution function. So this is my periodic focusing channel. So I have an applied electric field or magnetic field which is periodic in time, which means that the beam will move around a lot. And then I have all these blue regions which are empty. But here I have, as you see, very few grid points. These are the grid points, and the actual grid points I'm using are located mostly along where something is happening. So I can even show you a real simulation to see how this is evolving. So this is the same So here you see this is the distribution function which evolves in my uniform, in my periodic focusing channel. Then you can see the grid points which evolve along with the distribution function. And each color here represents one grid level. So you see the blue one here is the coarsest grid. Then you have this light blue, which is a finer grid. And then I stop to see if you remove the different grids. So I remove the second grid, then I remove one more. And these are the grid points on my finest grid. So you can add them again. And you see here that the grid points really follow the variations of the distribution function. This means that you have grid points only where things are varying a lot. So for example, where you have something which is flat or Gaussian or things that are very smooth function, you only need very few grid points. And this is it basically. So I'm coming back to my conclusions. So up to now we've only implemented it in two-dimensional phase space, but as you saw, it does a very good job in finding useful grid points. Depends, of course, on the problem. When you're doing, for example, Landau damping, at some point you have all this filamentation, then it fills up, you have most of the phase space which is full, then it's not useful anymore to do an adaptive simulation. But for example, for beam simulations or even for other kinds of plasma physics simulations where you have huge regions where nothing is really happening, you use a lot fewer grid points, and then it's of course a lot more efficient. Of course, you have an overhead due to the adaptivity because you have to do this hierarchical decomposition. You have to deal with more complicated data structure because you only store the grid points that you really have, which is not a uniform grid point. So there's a computational overhead, but because we are using a lot fewer points. In these cases, it's less than 10% of the actual points of the full grid, and for some simulation, it will be even less than that. It's efficient, and when we go up in dimension, I guess we'll have even a larger gain than that. And the method is based on a tensor product approximation, so it can be implemented in a straightforward manner up to six dimensions. The only problem is, of course, that we have to we probably need to parallelize, and because we have this adaptive data structure, we need to think a little bit about it in order to do it. This is why it hasn't been done yet. Okay, thank you.